gentleman I'm going to be interviewing, his name is Dwayne Chapman, but his nickname is Dog. And he's a very different interview. I've known Dog for, I guess, 6 or 7 years now. And Dog is one of the world's greatest bounty hunters. The story of his life is one that I think will inspire you and really once again teach you what human beings are capable of. And also, just a quick disclaimer, since Dog is a bounty hunter and he works in a quite different environment than our day-to-day lives, you might want to prepare yourself for some language that may be a little more intense than we normally have on Power Talks. But I'm sure seeing it in context, you'll see who this person really is and how it relates to basically his conditioning, what he has become as a human being, as well as the environment he's always in. But again, I think you'll really enjoy it, and I think you'll really see what a human being can do if they're truly committed, and what's really possible in our judicial system, what's really possible with virtually any human being. Well, welcome to Power Talk, the interview portion. And today I have a very, very special treat for you. I'm sitting across the room here from a very good friend of mine that I've known now for, what, 5 years we've known each other?
Six.
This is going to be a Power Talk I can promise you will never forget. And the person sitting across from me is Dwayne Chapman, also known as Dog. He is the last bounty hunter in the United States. Now, you may be getting some interesting pictures in your mind right now. And if you saw a dog, you'd have some interesting pictures too. You'd see a big grin and a really unique soul. But what's unique about Dog is his story. And I thought what I would do in this Power Talk is I may interject every now and then, but I'm really going to have Dog share with you his story. I've been bringing Dog out to my programs for about 5.5, 6 years now, and having people just get to hear what he's done with his life, the challenges he's met, how he's turned them around, the strategies he uses because he understands human nature so much, and just the growth he's gone through. Of all the people I know, I don't know of anyone that I have more respect for than you, Dog, and I really appreciate you taking the time to come visit with us.
Thank you, Tony. I appreciate you having me very much.
Well, you're an incredible man. Why don't we start out, we'll cut to the chase here, and let people know, since they don't know much about you, I should say this. Dog is known across the nation because of his capacity to really capture the bad guy, if you will, to make it simple. In the last, 11 years, 12 years, you've captured almost 3,500 felons. And averaging often one a day and sometimes getting two or three in a day, which is just absolutely unheard of. You know, if you talk to anybody in the police business, law enforcement business, it's unbelievable. And some of the stories that you share are incredible. But I'd like to start out by just having people get an idea, what are your roots? What's your story? Where did you come from? I know you had some challenges in your youth, I think, with your dad. Why don't we start there?
Well, I was raised in Denver, Colorado. At the age of about 9 years old, my mother was a minister or a missionary, and I would travel with my mother to the New Mexico reservation, the Navajo Indian reservation, and I would my mother would preach and tell her testimony. I would kind of take the offering and support my mom in various ways. And I was raised, my mother and father were very strict, not abusive, so to speak, but very strict in all with all the kids. Right. So I came from a very good background, very good moral background.
And what happened, though? There was a point where you really made a shift and you left the family.
My father and I started not getting along because back then my dad felt that spare the rod, spoil the child. And he felt like the rod was the way of correction all the way. And I think, in my opinion today, and I also think in his opinion today, he went a little too far. And because of the spankings, or I call them beatings, I ran away at the first time at the age of 12 years old, and I ran away about 60 miles on a bicycle and called my mom and dad up. I thought I was in California and told them I would never be home. And my dad said, please look up and tell me what you see. And I said, I see a sign that says Fort Morgan. And I thought since it said Fort that I was for sure in California. And it was actually 60 miles from home. So they came up there and picked me up, and that was the beginning, I think, of a runaway career.
Well, when did you leave for good?
About at the age of 15 years old, I moved in. I left my mom and dad's home, moved in with my grandfather, and started a life of, I could say, crime.
What happened?
Well, at 15, I joined a motorcycle gang. I was more of a gambler or a risk taker than anyone else. So at about 16 years old, I had a talent to persuade my way into certain circumstances or persuade my way out of certain circumstances. Right. And the president in the club, who was in his 40s, saw that and realized that. And everyone had a title, like there was president, vice president.
Of the motorcycle gang?
Of the motorcycle gang.
Wow.
We were, back then, 3,000 strong and in about 20 different states. So it wasn't like a local sidewalk commando group or a teenage gang from the streets. This was a nationwide
gang. What was the name
gang,
of the group?
Devil's Disciples.
Right.
So at 16, my president asked me, if someone came up to you and tried to take away your colors, and that's one thing we had to die for, was this piece of leather or the jacket itself that said Devil's Disciples. And he asked me, if someone tried to take this away from you, what would you do? And I said, well, you put your jacket on me and give me a gun and try to take it. And that impressed him, and he said, we're going to give you a position in the club, and it's called the Sergeant of Arms. And what you do as a Sergeant of Arms is you go start all the fights. You find the local drugs that are being sold by other organizations, not ours, and you basically get into these other clubs and find out their functions, and then you come and report to me about what was going on.
So at the goal of which was to rip them off, I guess.
Right. The goal was to take the drugs they had, or a lot of them ran different golf course clubs, parking lots, pawn shops, stuff like that. I would get in with them and see their secrets, and then my club would come in and take it.
By force?
By force.
Hmm. And you started the fights during those times too?
Yes.
Interesting. Now, let's talk about the night that changed your life. Actually, there have been a lot of nights that have changed your life, but let's talk about one of the major ones there, which was the night you guys went in to, I guess, do a bust and rip off some drugs from another club. What happened?
Well, I was living in Denver, and then I met a girl who I married and moved to a small town in Texas. I'd lived there about a year, and I was trying to mellow out some of my criminal activities. I was trying to be more an older biker and let the younger guys do the more dangerous and more illegal things, and I would kind of oversee. One night I got into the car with the vice president of the Devil Disciples, a couple girls and another gang member, and we went over to this man's house to purchase marijuana. We pulled up in front of the house. We were, you know, alcohol use was terrible. I think we were drinking Wild Turkey and chasing it with whiskey or something. So everybody was pretty intoxicated. And we pulled up to the house, and I told one of my brothers, whatever you do, don't take a gun up to this guy's door, because, you know, he was a well-known drug dealer. And back then, as today, guns and drugs do not mix. So I said, whatever you do, there were guns in our car. I said, don't take one up there. So he had a illegal sawed-off shotgun that he placed underneath his leather jacket, went to the door. There was a scuffle, and I heard a loud shot. As I was sitting in the car, I waited 2 or 3 minutes, and my brother came walking out of this guy's house holding his arm. And he got into the car. I was sitting in the back seat and looked over in the front seat, and I saw his hand was bleeding real bad. And I asked him what had happened. He said, I got it. And so I said, take him to the hospital right now, to one of the girls that was driving the car. So on the way to the hospital, he started telling exactly what happened. And I said, what happened? He said, the shotgun blew up in my hand. And I said, what are you talking about? And he said, I pulled it out. All I was going to do was tell him something. And he grabbed the end of the barrel and it went off. And I said, well, where did you hit him at? And he said, I hit him in the left shoulder, high on the shoulder. So I said, forget going to the hospital. Take me home immediately. So they drove me home. That night, I called the local town's emergency ward and the fire hospital, and had an ambulance go over to this where this had just happened. When I hung the phone up, little did I know it stayed off the hook. So in other words, if anybody tried to call me, it was busy.
Right.
I told the other people in the car, you guys get out of town. I'll check on what's going on. You guys call me later. I'll tell you how the guy is, how everything's going, what's up. So I went over to this house. The man that was shot was on a stretcher talking perfect, knew who I was, looked up at me, and said it was one of his brothers. And as he said that, all the police that were there looked at me and, you know, right away kind of didn't start questioning me, but looked at me like, and one of the officers came to my face and said, were you around here? And of course I said, I don't know nothing what he's talking about. I don't know what he means. So I went home. During the night, this happened at about 11 p.m. At about 1 o'clock a.m., this victim had passed away in the hospital, and it was on the news, on the radio. We didn't have TV that was all night back then, but it was on the radio and everything that this man had passed away. And of course, I worked the next day, so I was asleep. So my phone was off the hook. Everybody was trying to call me and warn me that the guy had passed away. My name might be passed around to get out of town also. So I woke up usually every morning about 6:30. So my alarm went off this morning to da-da-da-da. During the night, there has been a murder in Texas, and Dog Disciple is being sought for the shotgun slaying massacre of so-and-so age in the town in Texas. Of course, my wife woke up at the same time I did, and when I looked in her eyes, and I will never forget that look, and she just put her head on the bed and kind of shook her head. About 2 to 3 minutes later, heard a knock on the door, and it was the sheriff and his troops.
Wow.
And I told her, go to the door and say, I'm not here. So she went to the door and said, no, he's not here, he's at work. I worked about 4 or 5 blocks away. And in Texas, in the morning, you can hear almost everything. And so I heard the officers drive up to where I was supposedly working. Of course, my boss said he hadn't showed up for work yet. And I could literally hear the click of the siren as they clicked all their sirens on at the same time, because they knew kind of the gig was up. He was at home.
Right.
So I heard all the sirens coming back to the house. I kind of made a pact with my brothers that, you know, we all did. And when I say brothers, I don't mean blood brothers out of the same parents. But in this motorcycle club, we were all brothers. We would all die for each other. So we made a pact that if any of us would be taken, we would none of us be taken alive. So as the police were on their way, I grabbed a gun that I had in my house and I kicked the back door open, waiting to shoot it out with, you know, like Bonnie and Clyde. And as I went out the back door, there was no police there at all. And they had all converged on the front of the house, and they forgot to go around the back. So I ran a couple blocks, and each step I took, the more I shook and the scareder I got. And first I threw the gun, and then a dog was barking at me, and I looked at this little dog, and it was like looking at a pit bull or German Shepherd or something. I was just, fear was driving me. I stopped, and there was a police officer that I'd known for a couple years in the street, and I walked right up to the car, kind of ready to turn myself in, and I said, what's going on, officer? And he said, well, we're over here looking for this young man named Dog. And he looked at me and said, now, Dog, please be very nice, son. He said, put your hands on the front of the hood of my car. We've got something to talk to you about. And I told my wife to get in the car and get the camper ready, and let's get out of town, and I'll meet you 50 miles down the road.
Right.
So I looked down the road, and here comes the camper and the truck and the whole police department right behind her. Oh, wow. So I just stood there. The police got out and said, you're under arrest for first-degree murder. And what happened was I made bond, and I went to this guy and asked him, I said, what are you going to tell the police? He said, I don't know. It's up to my lawyer.
And he had been your brother all this time, right?
Right. And I said, well, you know, your lawyer doesn't wear a patch. He's not a devil's disciple. I'm telling you, what are you going to say when they, you know, these people are, I was a chartered member or a officer in the club, okay? So, and everyone in town knew that, and everyone on the streets knew that. So when it came down to blaming someone for doing it, of course it was the officer. So,
right.
You know, I was Dog Disciple.
Right.
And, you know, I was like a target, the best target to get. So the police department and the people in town thought, this is the guy that did it. So I went to him and said, now look, you know, I'm not saying nothing. The police came to me for questions. I said, I wasn't even there. I don't know what you're talking about till the day of trial. What are you going to say? And again, he said, I don't know what I'm going to say, Dog. I got to talk to my lawyer. So, you know, it really kind of blew me away. So I went to the club and I said, now I'm out on bond. And our rules were the only way you could leave the club was to be carried in a casket or to die or something. I said, so if you guys know where I live, if you want to kill me, be sure you send his lawyer to do it. So I did. And
oh,
I said,
gosh.
Well, here's your colors. And I sold my Harley Davidson in Texas to buy my attorney.
Wow.
And I said, you guys go on your way. There's your colors back, and I'll go on my way. So I stayed out on bond waiting trial for about a year. When the trial came, he went up to the on the stand, and his lawyer advised him not to speak. He said he realized that he had the gun. He realized that all he remembered was him going for the gun. There was a bang, his hand hurt. The next thing he knew, he was in the car and I was taking him to the hospital. My attorney said, well, did you shoot the guy? He said, I don't really know if I did or not. He said, well, did Dwayne shoot the guy? And he said, no, Dwayne didn't get out of the car. Did the other person, there was two other people in the car with me, did they shoot the guy? He said, no, they didn't get out of the car too, but I don't know if I shot the guy. So we went through a week of trial. The jury deliberated for an hour and a half. In those days, if there was no such thing as accessory before, during, or after the fact. If you were there and you didn't call the police right after a crime occurred, you were guilty of not only association, but you were guilty of the actual crime.
So you weren't charged with accessory to murder, you were charged with murder.
Right. Five of us were charged with premeditated first-degree murder. I can say an hour and a half later, the jury came back in. The foreman of the jury was my ex-boss. And he stood up and said, and looked, especially I thought at least, was looking in my eyes and said, we the jury find the defendant, Dwayne Lee Chapman, guilty as charged. You know, I was just, I don't know the word, flabbergasted, astonished, overwhelmed. I was
you're using all those softeners we teach right now.
It was looking kind of bad.
But we really feel it. Looking kind of bad.
Looking kind of bad. So, you know, I sat there. Everybody emptied the news reporters ran outside to print. This was the first actual murder this town had had. So all the news people were there, the news media, and everybody ran out of the courtroom real fast. Mothers were hugging their sons and daughters. And I sat there because I was kind of like in shock. I couldn't get up from where I was sitting. And my attorney came to me and said, well, you know, that's it. You can come back in 2 weeks and they're going to sentence you. And I had never, you know, I thought, what? And my grandpa came down and made a cash bond. And I went out in 24 hours. I felt that the town owed me some kind of something back. So
you did the original Rambo.
I did the original Rambo on the town.
Yeah, I heard from many people about what you did. What did you do?
Shut up some cop cars and burn some things down. And
so, you're talking about it so softly now.
Yes,
I mean, I remember when you and I first met, and you described this with a lot more intensity years ago.
But there is such a thing in America, thank God for America, not only for this, but called statute of limitations, and that means any felony that's over 5 to 7 years old, you can talk about it. But even as I talk about it, still gives me the creeps to admit it or to talk about it.
Yeah.
So we went back and forth. They wanted to give me more charges for a couple days. And finally they came back and said, now, if you take 5-year sentence in Texas Department of Corrections and promise not to appeal this murder conviction, we promise not to try you for arson, attempted murder of a police officer, firing a firearm, firing automatic weapons. They had a list of charges. So of course I agreed. So I walked into the courtroom with my attorney, and the judge, McElhaney, sentenced me to 5 years of hard labor, which I had no idea what that word meant, in the Texas Department of Corrections, and to be transported to Huntsville, Texas, immediately. There were 60 men in a bullpen waiting, and my name was Chapman, and then they take you alphabetically. There wasn't any A or B's, and they called me first, and all the prison guard had was the sentence, 5 years, charge, murder, and your name. So this two prison bus guards said, well, you got lucky, Chapman, on a 5-year murder sentence. Take all your clothes off right now, grab your ankles, bend over. And I said, I'm not gonna get naked in front of 60 men that I don't know standing right here. And they said, yeah, you are. And I said, well, you got me all wrong. So one of the officers grabbed me on the right side of my Levi's, the other one grabbed me on the left. Before I knew it, they had ripped literally in half my Levi's. Before I knew it, they had ripped my shirt clear off, and before I knew it, they had grabbed my drawers and ripped them off. And they said, now if you want to bend over normally, you can bend over. If you want to have one of us bend you over, we'll do that. So as fast as I could, I bent over, touched the ground, and stood back up. I realized at that point right there, there was something different about this thing. I then rode a prison chain bus, they call it, for 2 days from where I was to Huntsville, Texas. And I always refer to it as the bus from hell, because if there is a bus to hell, that's exactly what it's like. So the next day they gave us different farms that we were assigned to. Mm-hmm. I was assigned to, because of the charge, one of the hardest farms back then that there was, which was called East Ham.
Yes.
It was called the Burning Ham because it's never under 90 degrees in any place in the place, in the buildings, outside. It's always at least 90 degrees in the hallways. And about the first week I got there, I tried everything I could do not to show up for work. I had it paid a guy to be me out in the field because I could see these guys coming in bleeding, and I could see their heads were bleeding and their backs were bleeding, their arms were bleeding. And I thought, whatever this is, there's no way that I want to do this. I had this one boss named Boss Espinoza, and he had first seen me the first day I got to prison, and he started looking around and he said, "Where's the Blue Eyes at?" And he said, "I seen him here a week ago. Where's he been?" And they caught me not going out in the fields and other people. So I had to work all day the first day I worked. And what we did was put a sack on our back and walked 4 or 5 miles a day picking cotton.
And you were chained also, just like the movies.
Right, just like Cool Hand Luke. We had chains going from our left ankle to another person's left ankle. Me, though, because of my charge, and I had broken out of the jail, and I was an escape risk, or what they said had rabbit in his blood, I was chained to myself. Mm. So I had leg irons, 8-inch leg irons to myself. And so I worked out in the fields. I wanted to throw down the Aggie or throw down the cotton sack and quit. But when you did, you lost not only your job, but your manhood. If you threw the cotton sack down, you were the woman for that night.
Wow.
For the whole.
What you call a little bit of leverage, huh?
Yes.
Pain. So what happened? I mean, you felt like there was nothing you could do, but you found a way out of it.
Right, there was nothing I'd do, and this same boss one day had sicked this guy on me, just hit me in the mouth, and this guy hit me in the mouth in the fields, and he said, I just looked at him and kept working, and I was in line, and this black guy said, "Are you a homosexual?" And I said, "No." He said, "Well, you're gonna be tonight." And I said, "Why are you saying that?" And he said, "Man, if anybody hits you like that, you got to hit him back." And I said, "But I don't want to lose my good time, and I don't want to get in trouble. It's better to lose your good time than it is your manhood." So I said, "Well, what do I do?" He said, "Well, the first thing when we catch out in the morning, you better attack that guy." So the next day, we had the first water break, and then that's exactly what I did. And my talent for boxing, I've always, like I said, my father was a boxer, so I was always good, as they say, skin on skin. So this guy was an easy fight, and he did try to defend himself, but I fought good. And I noticed that this one boss was grinning, and he liked that I was 5'7 and could handle myself. And I saw that through the corner of an eye, and then when I came back into the line, he told me, "Good job." This boss then transferred me behind the line, and I would stand with the boss. The boss was on a horse with a 30-30 rifle. I would stand by the boss and his horse, and the new guys that came in, the boss would give me a look and nod his head at the new guys, and I would go up to the new guys and pat him on the shoulder and say, "Hey, you're not doing your job like these guys are doing. If you don't keep doing your job, I'm gonna beat you up," only in different words.
Yeah, more intense, huh?
More intense. And so
And you did.
And so that was my job.
You go up and just belt the guys.
Right, I was called a striker. So when the boss would be sitting on his horse and he would look, he would yell, "Dog, I want my dog," because they like that name, you know. And they'd say, "Get him, dog, be a striker." And then I knew this guy, and his name was Skinner. That was his nickname. And he was one of the baddest guys in prison. And he said, "Tomorrow I'm killing you." Well, Skinner did this. I mean, when he said this, "I'll break your face," he literally broke your face. Or if he said, "I killed you," he killed you. So, you know, again, I'm laying in my cell praying, what can I do? Or God, give me something. So anyway, about 7 in the morning before High Noonsville was ready, I heard a Martin Luther King on the radio station. We were allowed to have radios. And, you know, this guy, I the Lord is on the mountain, and I heard this enthusiasm coming out of this dungeon of hell, one voice of enthusiasm coming. So when they opened the cells, I got to quick as I could to where this voice was, and there was Skinner sitting on his bunk with tears in his eyes, listening to this guy who was called Dr. Martin Luther King on the radio, crying. And I said, "Skinner, who is that guy?" And he absolutely went crazy. He said, "You ever come around my cell again, I'm going to kill you, dog. I'm going to kill you anyway today. And what you doing?" And I said, "Well, who's that man talking that stuff, saying that?" And the part right then, he said, Dr. Martin Luther King said, "I see a white child walking with a black child hand in hand." And as that words came out of the radio, I'm looking straight in Skinner's eyes, and you know, I'm wanting to grab his hand right there and say, "Look, this guy is talking about us, you know, some kind of, you know, give me something to call this monster off of me, you know." But all I needed was my eyes, and he kind of looked in my eyes. Noon came by, we went to eat. I looked over at Skinner. Everybody else did too. He put his tray down real hard when it was ready to turn in his silverware, and he didn't do nothing.
You changed what he associated to you.
Exactly. When he thought of me, I was hoping to God he thought of Martin Luther King, or at least me catching him at the door, and yeah. I found his weakness, which was not a weakness to me, but it was to him, Martin Luther King. So from then on, Skinner liked me, and I wasn't one of the tough guys of the penitentiary, but all the tough guys knew that I was Dog and that I was cool. So I was kind of insulated with these tough guys, you right. know, like a blanket. So that was the first, I guess, miracle that saved my life. Because usually in those days, with my body frame, 5'7", 145 pounds, blue eyes, white boy, you didn't come out of Texas without changing your physical appearance and your sexual preference.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just how it was back then. So I didn't ever have to fight for my manhood, only to Skinner, you know, as close as that got. Another thing that helped that I became, and I don't mean known, but I became known as far as throughout the penal institution. When I first got there, a guy came up to me and asked me my opinion on a scripture in a Bible. And I had to get a Bible for reference. "Where's it at? I'll show it to you. Give me a Bible." They looked everywhere. "Ain't no Bibles here." I said, "What?" No one had a Bible. Finally, I found one. I got to make my point. But I noticed that none of these guys had a Bible. So I opened up this thing. And since the last time I talked to you, I remember the guy's name was Chaplain Ray. And it said, "Order free Bibles." And I thought, wow, man, if I can get all these Bibles for these guys, this is going to be fantastic. And I didn't plan how it came out. All I was going to do was order Bibles. And the UPS truck pulled up in front of the gate, and it was like one or two great big huge UPS, and they blew the horn. Beep. They had to call inmates to carry the boxes. So they put all these boxes in the hallway. No one still knew nothing. The warden brought me in and said, "What's going on?" I said, "Warden, I don't know." He said, "Well, you ordered all these Bibles." So some of these guys had been in prison for, you know, I would say, to let's say the word 10 years, because some of them had been there 20, and never had received a piece of mail. So the guards would take this mail bag or these boxes, and they'd start, and each Bible came in its own little box with the guy's name on it from Chaplain Ray and all that, and they would stand out there. David Jones, little Davey, never got ever any mail. "Here, boss." And he'd come up there and they'd hand him. And so pretty soon, I mean, all these guys that never got mail and all these guys that never got anything, some never got a wrapped gift, okay? I really mean this. Some never got a gift that was wrapped. I mean, they got a gift, but their mom had put it in a Safeway sack and handed it to them or something like that. But that's what all I was hearing. Then the warden let me back in my cell. I looked like that, and there was a line starting to develop outside my cell. I said, "What's going on?" And David said, little Davy Jones, the same little guy who was in there 99 years for rape and never did actually rape the girl, said, "Well, dog, you got to sign these Bibles." And I said, "Well, what do I sign them as? You know, when I got a Bible, they'd say Reverend so-and-so."
Right.
And I said, "Well, what do I sign him as?" And he said, "Just put plain the dog."
Yeah.
And so I put, and so you couldn't put love. I mean, you know, but I did, but you couldn't put that in writing. So I just put from, to, because some I didn't remember their name. You know, some I only seen like two or three times. I'd say, "What's your name?" "David Jones." "David Jones from the dog. Thank you very much, dog." And that was it. So everybody knew that, you know, that was another way that I believe that God bless me to keep me alive in the Texas Department of Corrections.
You actually had so many people outside your door, outside your cell rather, that you got in trouble, didn't you?
The warden wanted to write me up for inciting a riot. So one day I was sitting in the cell, and I was a striker, and I was cool because I worked for Boss Espinoza, but I still couldn't, you know, I couldn't be myself. I still had to be this, work for this boss who could barely speak English. And I saw this guy walking down the hallway, and he had all white on. We all wore white, but his whites were real white, bleached and starched. and he had like old Sky King gloves on. And when he walked down the hallway, everybody said hi to him. And he said hi back, and I thought, man, who is this guy right here? Look at the respect he's got. Look at how everybody's treating him. And so...
And he smelled good.
I remember you telling me that. That's right. He smelled good. And so I walked up to him, and I said, man, what do you do here? And he said, I'm the warden's barber. And I said, well, what is that? And he said, I cut all the guards' hair. I got my own barber shop outside the gate. So anyway, I thought, you know, there's some, this guy's got just so much respect, so much rapport. So I talked to this warden's barber, and he said he was about 2 months short. Short meant in 2 months he was going home. And I said, man, I want to be what you are. And he said, well, you a barber in the world? I said, no, but I'm going to be one. He said, well, you mess up, dog, in the barbershop, you're done. They take all your good time, everything. You mess up a guard's hair, you're done. So I don't know where the book came from, but I found a book that I believe was published in the 1930s. And in the prison at 10 o'clock at night, you couldn't, lights out, it said. That means all lights were out. You got caught with anything, reading material, anything, you went straight to the hole, which we called the shitter, which is still called that. So I took toilet paper and I rolled it up real tight in my hands, and I made like a little torch, and I would flush the toilet, and as the suction of the toilet would flush, I would light this toilet paper and fan it so the smoke would go down the toilet paper, and I'd try to read a chapter or a page or 2 pages per night of this like 400 page book. I couldn't be caught with this book in my cell on my person, because you know I'm out in the fields fighting all day. I couldn't put this book on me because it was a free world book. It didn't come from the prison library. It was smuggled in years and years ago, so I had to leave it in my cell, in a certain place in my cell even. So you know that's why it took me so long to read it. That's why I had to read it at night.
How long did it take you to read it?
You know, I'm not sure, but after the old warden's barber left, which was about 2 months, I was about halfway through the book when I started cutting hair.
Oh, no.
And as you know, I caught myself up as I would do something with the hair, then I'd read it that 2 days later in the book and say, oh, that's what it meant. You know, like cutting them a certain way or tapering. Right. The guy said, I want my hair tapered. I thought, you know, taper, is that the end of a shovel is tapered? I had no idea what none of that was, because I was a long hair when I was a kid.
Right.
You know, at 13 years old, I ran away because my dad said, go get a haircut. I took the $2 and tried to make it to L.A., you know. So
I interrupted you, though. So how did you end up actually cutting hair? What happened? You read this book.
Read the book, and I went to the warden, and I said, warden, you know, I'm a good guy. He said, well, you know, we hope so. I said, I was a barber in the world, warden. And, you know, right, straight face, looked right in the eye, and you were, huh? And I said, yeah. He said, well, then you can try to be a barber here. So I went out there, and here comes Warden Horton, and he sat down in the chair. And I already had a plan. The shoeshine boy was a black guy, and him and I became as more brothers than me and the original biker. And I said, now, Ronnie, you know, what am I going to do here? And so he said, we'll get a little hair, and we'll put it on the ground. And so I would, you know, maybe cut an eighth of an inch off once in a while of hair of the warden, and I would try to get it on the ground. Ronnie Coleman was walking around the warden once in a while, and you'd see his hand drop a little bit of hair that he got from somewhere, you know. And pretty soon we had it all set up like a booby trap where the warden would look down and there was hair, you know, he definitely had a haircut. So the warden went along with this, you know, fine, how's that look? And I put a little Brill cream, I think it was, or something in it to pin it back a little extra special, you know, comb it down a little bit. And I said, now, how's that look, warden? And he said, fine. And I spun him around to look at the back and help. You know, I didn't even really know how to hold the mirror so he could see the back of his head. But I went through all the stuff I'd seen on TV, and I'm, you know, trying to bring in all these memories of being a real free world barber.
Right.
So I made it through the warden. You know, I felt real good and took the zeal off of him and shook it out, made it pop and made it, you know, real cool, folded it up, held it over my arm and stood there waiting on the next guard, you know. This is amazing, this is true. So I got up in the morning, warden's barber, now. I knew something's wrong. So I get to the barber shop, the shoeshine, Ronnie Coleman's already there. There's Warden Horton again. He said, dog, guess what? He said, my wife looked at this hair job that you did, and he said, all the back right here is about a quarter of an inch shorter than this over here. This over here, he said, I'm going to tell you something, dog, if you don't cut this hair a TDC, Texas Department of Corrections, standard haircut with a tapered back. You're going to the hole for lying to the warden. You know, I don't know what happened. I just took the clippers in my hand and I closed my eyes and I looked at that book and it said, lay the clippers against the skull and raise it. And so I laid the clippers against his skull and raised it up the back of his neck. And I mean, the hair went on my hand and down the thing. And I thought, oh my God, you know, this guy's going to look like a skunk with a stripe right here. And then I did the other side like that and then the other side. And pretty soon I noticed the back is tapered. And then I trimmed it up and I got him ready, put some aftershave on him and turned him around to the mirror. I said, what's that look like, Warden? He said, that's a fine job, dog.
So you began to breathe.
So he said, that's good. So I thought, you know, that was the second day now. And the second day I cut the warden's hair. Third day I came again, wake up, went out again. There was the warden again. He said, now you've kind of got the style down. But he said, again, this is a quarter of an inch longer than this side. He said, now what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you 3 days. And what you're going to do then is you're going to cut everybody's hair in the shitter. And when you get done with all them men, you better be able to make my head even. Now, in the shitter were these people, Vietnam veterans that could not speak anymore. They kept on Valiums. Men whose mothers were killed or raped while they were in prison. Men whose wives were killed and raped while they were in prison. Men who could not speak to a normal man without tearing his throat out. I mean, this is, you know, and they get a haircut about once every 2 months when they want to throw bait in there to these guys. You know what I'm saying? So here I am. And I have one guard standing by me, and they start bringing all these guys in. 3 days of that, I was ready to cut the warden's hair again. The warden did not come back like in 2 days and make me level out his hair. He came back in a couple weeks when his haircut was ready. So one day we were sitting there, and there was a guard that was about 6'5", 200 pounds, 23 or 4 years old. His name was Big Lou. His real name was Lieutenant Hillegast, and they called him Big Lou. Everybody respected him. He was a big man, but he was very mean. If you were on his side, he was on your side to the death. But if you lied to him or, you know, you screwed him around, he was a perfect prison guard, and he was a lieutenant and the youngest lieutenant in the system. So one day, Big Lou had just, it was hunting season in Texas. And all the guards had been hunting together. Well, Big Lou, who was supposed to be the meanest, the biggest, the toughest, and the best shot, was standing out there and missed 2 shots at a deer. So when he came to work that day, all the guards were saying, Big Lou, because they didn't like him, because they were all jealous of him, because he was so cool. And they said, yeah, you see old Big Lou miss that baby deer so easy, shot 25 feet over its head. Right then I looked at my shoeshine brother Ronnie Coleman, and we knew, Big Lou's coming to work today. He missed a deer. He's mad. Because when he was mad, he was a guard. He showed that. I'm having a bad day and you're going to die. I mean, that's just how they are. So, you know, we knew. So we could, here come Big Lou. And I mean, he threw his coat down and I want them boots shined. And I mean, he was crazy. You want a haircut today, boss? No, I just want a facial. And I knew this guy's mad. You can't do nothing wrong. So anyway, the shitter was across the street in the barbershop. And we had an inmate that everybody called Bigfoot. And he was a young black kid, bigger than Big Lou. Him and his girlfriend had a fight. And I seen a boss had him handcuffed because they went into his cell and arrested him and brought him out to the shitter. And this boss had him handcuffed. The guard uncuffed him, started opening the cell door. Bam, he hit him, jumped out of there. And we were right on the road, the barbershop was, away from the prison, a couple blocks away. He was on his way to freedom, which was really nowhere. I mean, you had to run for 10 miles before you found a real person. You know, it was all prison property. So Bigfoot's running. Big Lou's coming out of the chair, screaming, pushing me out of the way with this towel. I'm standing there in shock, and my shoeshine guy is standing there looking at me like, do something, dog, because I'm the guy out there to do something. Big Lou pulls a gun, his .38, out of his holster, puts it right down on Bigfoot's back. I jumped in front of Big Lou, direction of fire. Now, I mean, I didn't jump in front of him and say, hey, don't shoot, waving my hands. My back was to him, and I kind of acted like I got in the way, and as I got in the way, I said, catch him, Coleman, like that, and Ronnie started running after him. I looked at Big Lou's body language. He didn't try to shoot my shoeshine boy, so he knew right then, he heard that I said, go catch him, Coleman. I saw Big Lou kind of drop the gun, so that meant I could run too, so I took off running too. So here's me and Ronnie Coleman running after Bigfoot with Big Lou just standing there waiting to see, you know, what's going to happen. Ronnie gets there first, I get there second. We get him down in this, on the ground. We put his face, Ronnie's holding him by the head. I'm holding his, you know, I mean, this is a big man throwing us both like rag dolls all around. I'm saying, Bigfoot, don't run, brother. No, dog, let me go, let me go. Bigfoot, no. Pretty soon, click, click, you move, I'll blow your brains out. There's Big Lewis, this 38 right to Bigfoot's head. Said, you move, I'll blow, and Bigfoot's begging him, blow my brains out, please. I told him, don't listen to him, Big Lou, give me your cuffs. Throws down his handcuffs. I said, Ronnie, get that arm. Ronnie Coleman looked at me all crazy, like, you know, what are you trying to do, make me put these handcuffs on this man? I said, Ronnie, get that arm. He grabbed the guy's arm. I put the first man I ever put handcuffs on. I put one cuff on, got the other one, cuffed him up, stood him up. Big Lou, whatever he did to Bigfoot, took him into the shitter, locked him up. We went back to the barber shop. Big Lou didn't even acknowledge that I did anything, didn't say one word to me, you know, treated me like a scum. I went into population that night. I was sitting in my cell about 5 minutes. They called me Warden's Barber. They said, we want to talk to you. Shoeshine, Ronnie Coleman, we want to talk to you. So we think, you know, what's wrong? Well, the warden's looking right at me, the same Warden Horton, I had just cut his hair, and who I thought I was starting to get some rapport with, said, we're transferring you. You just ran down an inmate. There's no way you're going to be alive in here. You just ran down another inmate. He said, come night, they're going to slit your throat, dog, and I ain't having your mama and your daddy sue the Texas Department of Corrections. So I told the warden, I said, look out, warden. I'm not going to die in there. I said, I know what I'm going to say. He said, what are you going to say? And Big Lou has not said a word yet. So I say, and no one ever talked like this to the guards, ever, ever, still to this day. I said, Warden Horton, that man missed a deer when he was shooting. And I mean, Big Lou kind of got up on his chair like that. And I said, you know he would have shot that man in the back. And the warden said, that's his job. I said, but I saved that man's life, warden. I didn't run an inmate down. I saved his life. It's not like Big Lou paid me to do that. Big Lou's job was to drop him. Big Lou, we all know, is the kind of man he is. He was mad, warden. Ever all the other guards were teasing him about missing a deer that day. He would have shot him, warden. He'd have shot him anyway. But I saved his life, warden. He said, is that what you're going to tell them fools in there? I said, yes, sir. He said, I'll give you 2 hours after lights out. If you're still alive, I'll let you stay. So we walk in. You know, already, when you're in prison and you go to see the warden, everybody comes to you, what happened, what happened? It's like winning the lottery, you know. What numbers did you have? You know what I'm saying? Everybody surrounded us, what happened, what happened? And I told Ronnie, don't you say a word, you let me talk. Because already word, exactly like the warden said, had started getting out.
That you guys had run down a guy.
Dog chased down an inmate. Dog chased down Bigfoot and turned him over to Big Lou. That's what the word was when we hit the cell block. And I tell the inmates the story, you know. I tell them the story of Big Lou going hunting. And a couple of them had heard it from their bosses out in the field that day. And, you know, everybody was, yes, we heard he missed that deer. I said, man, he's fixing to blow his head off. I said, I dove in front of that guy, and I seen, like, Skinner, as I started telling the story, Skinner said, oh, he'd walk away and go play dominoes. I thought, oh, there, I just sold Skinner. There's the first step. And the more, you know, as like when you're selling an item and you do the first close, it works, the second, third, fourth, and pretty soon, bam, you hammer home. And that's how I was doing. I was selling each tough guy there. And finally, I could see the look on their face and everything. And Coleman sitting in the background shaking, you know, that I had, and I really did not chase down an inmate. I really did try to save Bigfoot's life. I really knew that Big Lou was there. I mean, I really wasn't being a farce, because I think if I would have tried to be, I'd have lost.
And yeah, I wouldn't, they would have sensed it.
I wouldn't have made it those 2 hours.
Yeah.
So anyway, the next day, the first people that got up in the morning were the milkers and then the warden's barber. So one of the milkers came by my cell and said, dog. And when I moved, he said, Warden Horton just said, make sure you're still alive. So we worked all day. I didn't see the warden. I didn't see Big Lou. That night, Big Lou came on duty like at 3:30. And Big Lou called me into the kitchen, and me and Ronnie Coleman. And he said, sit down. And I sat down. And he said, you really did that for me? I said, that's right, boss. You'd have killed that man. He said, you betcha I would have killed him. I never said, would you have killed him if you wouldn't have missed the deer? I wanted to, but I couldn't say that. But I could tell in his face, he didn't really want to kill a man. He was a prison guard. He didn't really want to do that, and he really knew that I did save him, and he was kind of telling me by these words by saying, "Dog, your bread is buttered." And I took that being from the city, meaning you're all right, right? Well, I get in the hallway, and Ronnie says, "What's that mean?" And I said, "That means we're cool. Our bread is buttered. We're done." I said, "No, we're not done, brother. That means we're all right. If we're all right with Big Lou, we're all right in this penal institution." And that's really how it was. And so one day, one of the guards said, like in December, right before Christmas, is like December 23rd. I shouldn't say like, because I remember the exact dates.
Yes.
It was December 23rd, and the guard said, "You're on the list." And I said, "That's impossible." I said, "I know it is, dog, but you're on the list." And there was two sad days. There was one sad day in prison. The first day I hit there, when them guards ripped my pants off, I completely changed all my morals at that point and have never went back to this day. At that second, if they'd have let me go right after that, I'd be the same guy I am today. And the second thing was the day I left prison. None of my friends would talk to me. My friends, again, were the guards. They wouldn't say nothing. The day that I was leaving to catch a chain out, they wouldn't say goodbye, dog. They didn't even want to look at me. They didn't tell me goodbye. They didn't say nothing. So I come to find this out after I got out a year or two later. I called. I said, "Mr. Ironhorn, why did you dog me like that? Why didn't you tell me goodbye? We don't want to see you back." And I waited. You know, you see the prison movie, the guy goes in. You see it when he goes out. What do they tell him? "You'll be back." No one told me that. Maybe that's why I never went back. I mean, I know that's wonderful. Not why, but that is amazing that no one told me that.
But when you got out, you were planning on being back, weren't you?
Oh, absolutely. Guarantee it.
What were you planning on doing when you left?
A lot of people's heard the song, "Hey Joe." I wanted to get a gun, and I thought that my ex-wife had done me wrong and went with, married one of my friends, and I was planning, Texas Department of Correction gives you $200, and I cashed a check, bought a gun. I bought something else I hadn't had in a couple years at a bus station in the bathroom. And I got on the bus with the 25 automatic, a suit, and headed back to Texas on an airplane to take care of the guy who took away my woman.
And what happened?
I got on the airplane. First, I walked through the metal detector I'd never seen in my life.
Yeah, because they didn't have them when you went in.
They didn't have them when I went in. I had no idea what it was. The alarm went off, and I looked back and looked at the thing, and the guy said, "What do you got there?" And I said, "I don't know." And I realized right then, I said, "What is that?" He said, "That's a metal. You got any kind of metal on you or anything?" And I realized, you know, I'm just 4 hours out. I got a 25 automatic in my waist. I got this finger hut suit on, and I'm going back to prison before I get a chance to shoot this guy. So I said, "It must be my belt." Or, so, you know, I don't know why I even thought of it. I just looked down and seen metal. I said, "It must be my belt." And this guy said, "Oh, I don't know." I said, "Now look, buddy, I just got out of the penitentiary and I told you it's my belt. Go ahead." So I used that to get by that thing. So today when I go through with the prisoners, it's nothing like going through back then. I mean, I can go through the toughest rent-a-guard there is because I went through the real ones back then. So anyway, I went through, I got on the airplane, there was a redheaded guy. And he just came up and sat by me, and I started buying these little bitty bottles for $2 or $3 back then, $2 I think it was, and vodka, and I just started drinking them. And I've always tried to remember if he said any cuss words, because I really do believe he was really an angel. But all of a sudden he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm finna kill this guy." "What are you gonna do?" And I said, "I'm gonna shoot this guy who took my woman." "Well, what happened?" I said, "Well, you know," I told him the whole story. And you know, I'm very kind of a macho guy. I'm not a chauvinist pig, but I'm a macho guy. And I don't want this guy getting next to me, just coming out of prison, giving me any kind of advice, especially a man, okay? A woman, I'll listen to anything coming out of there. But you know, I didn't want this man. He's telling me, "You can't do that. You shouldn't be like that. There's people out there that love you. What about this? What about that?" Putting all those basics from home back into my ear. And I thought that's where they're going, is in one ear, out the other. But they were going right straight to the heart.
This session continues on the next CD.
So I got off the plane. I'm very lit. This redheaded guy's walking right behind me. I thought that the redheaded guy called my mom or dad or some way got my mom and dad a message. My mom now tells me when she saw me come off the ramp and as I was walking, the redheaded guy motioned to my mom and goes like this. My mom raised her son.
Yes.
My mom looks at the guy and knows exactly what he's saying. My mom whispers to my father. My dad hugs me, reaches right in my waist and grabs a hold of it, takes it. My dad still can whip me to this day, takes it right out of my waist and looks me right in the eyes and says, good to have your son home, son. And I, you know, break down and say, Dad, but I got to do this. No, you don't, my dad said. And my mom starts crying and we hug. And that was it. I mean, my dad took away the gun. So, I tried to find my sons and visit. I couldn't find my ex-wife. I couldn't find my sons. I sold all my property. And for like 3 or 4 years, and in prison when I got real nervous, they would give me these Valiums, okay? But when I was doing drugs in the streets, we didn't do Valiums. I mean, Valiums was not a drug that we could go get at a drug house or something like that. I've seen them in Texas prison. And so I went to this doctor and I said, I just got out of the penitentiary. He said, for what? I said, murder. Oh, what do you need? I said, I'm nervous, man, real bad, and I need something to calm me down. I said, would you like some Valiums? I said, sure. What are they? He said, well, we'll give you these blue Valiums, and you do 3 or 4 a day and get yourself on them. You'll be able to function. And how long do I do them? He said, about 6 months. So I do 4 at a time, you know. I mean, I mean some even 6 and 8 at a time. I run out in about 3 days of 30 or 40 Valiums. And I realize I take these little blue pills, and I don't feel no pain no more. Thought's still there. I can see it, but I can't feel it. I go to him and say, that's not enough of them things. Oh, you can't do this. I'm going to do it. Now, I told him this. I said, from now on, your doctor feel good, and I'm sick, and I need some more of them pills. So he
kept, if he said no to you, what'd you say to him?
Oh, he didn't say no because of the way I presented it to him when I said, your doctor feel good, and I'm sick. You got it? He knew, you know, what I was trying to. I knew I'd been in prison. I couldn't say, if you don't give me those drugs, I'm going to burn your house down. But because of being there, I was taught to say those things with my eyes and my attitude. He got a hold of my mother. My mother said, I'll keep him in the basement. Give him the pills. That's okay. Because, you know, mom didn't know. She thought, without these pills, this guy's going to go crazy. He's going to go down there and kill this guy. He's going to do this, do that. So the doctor gives me the pills for almost a year. I develop an infection on my neck. I mean, I get crazy. I mean, I get goofy. I get, my muscles start contracting. Oh, the hair on my head quits growing. I mean, there's so many crazy things that go on. The mirror gets all crazy. You know, instead of them being a muscle relaxer, they became like a hallucinogenic to me because I overdosed everything on these things. So then I meet a girl and, in prison, they tell you the first girl you meet, don't fall in love with her. You should, date, but don't fall in love. Well, the first girl I met, I fall in love, I think, and I make a baby. And she's going through her pregnancy, and all of a sudden, this little baby's born, and I think he's born on the fifth and a half month. And so I'm dying waiting on my two sons. I'm looking for my sons who I had from the previous marriage, who I was a good father to. And then I have this girlfriend gets pregnant with a baby. And I think, man, this is going to take over the longing of these two sons that I had. I get to have this baby. So he's born premature. They walk in there and they put their hands all over him. You know, we don't wear a mask. You know, I could see that they didn't have much hope in my baby, the way they were touching him with non-sterile stuff. And so,
how much did he weigh?
He weighed 1 pound. 1 pound. I still have a picture of him. And so they said, well, this baby's going to die. You can sit in the room here while it dies. Okay, fine. My girlfriend goes out. I'm sitting there. I say, okay, now here's where we start this, God. Here's where we start using these combinations about Bigfoot running from that gate. And here's where we start about the redhead in the airplane. And here's where I gave you these promises. Now here's where we're going to start this again. And I said, you ain't going to let this baby die. Because I know that the Bible says whatever you ask and think in Jesus' name will be done. It's going to be done. And I lay my hands without a Bible on this little baby, and I call him Zebediah, because that's a name in the Bible. And I said, Zebediah Dwayne Chapman, you ain't going to die. You're going to live, and I'm going to be your daddy. And so, you know, we wait 3 or 4 hours, and The nurse comes in the room and she says, you know, he's breathing now. And, you know, all of a sudden miracles started happening. It started happening so much that all Channel 4, Channel 7, and Channel 9 in Denver ran a special on my son, and they called him Zebediah Dwayne Chapman, the miracle baby. So each day I had to go to the hospital at 9:30 in the morning. Oh, I couldn't do them Valiums at 7:30 at night because I was too high by 10 o'clock. I couldn't do, I could only do two Valiums tonight because I got to get up in the morning. I got to go to the hospital and talk to the nurses about Zeb. Pretty soon I'd stayed from the hospital from 9 till 3. I didn't have no Valiums. Pretty soon at 4 o'clock I could do a Valium, and I thought, why? Because I got to go tomorrow and talk to some radiologist, and then tomorrow I got to talk to some something else ologist, and then another boss to that ologist, and boy, I don't even know what this stuff means. And if I'm on Valiums, I can't even act like I know what it means, you know? So that kind of weaned me slowly off the Valiums, because there's so many with Zebediah back then. He was at Children's Hospital in Colorado General, and he was, I don't want to say he was an experiment, okay, but I want to say that no other baby in the world had lived that long. I'm talking 3 and 4 days they died. No, that's why they called him the miracle baby.
Well, he also had heart problems, did he?
Every disease there was. I mean, he had a hole in his heart. It healed itself. He had intestinal holes in his intestines. They healed. He blew out his lung. They blew out his lung. They put a respirator, you know, deal in his mouth, and his lungs were big enough, and they blew a hole in it, and then it healed itself. Now, all these things heal themselves, especially on a child. And this is what all these doctors were telling me. I would go, and they'd say, well, he's got a hole in his lung. But we're going to tell you it can be healed. And I couldn't be high to hear how it was going to be healed, because I needed to help that healing. Whether it was supernatural or physical, I needed to know where to put my mind to help the healing. And you know what I'm saying. So I had to be straight when I talked to these professional doctors.
Right.
So all of a sudden, for about 4 or 5 days, no Valiums whatsoever. And then I remember smelling a Valium. I remember opening the thing up and smelling that and thinking, man, yuck. Closing the lid, till this day, that's it. Never. Now, I've taken them as far as getting a bad headache or something, but I have never abused them or even asked for them. I don't have a prescription now, don't want one, and haven't been to a doctor in over 10 years for them, okay? But when I smelled that, and then when I threw the Valiums away, then the next day, the doctor called me and they said, little Zeb is sick again. So I talked to God, and I said, you know, I don't know what's going to happen. And as I was getting ready to talk, the hospital called and said, Zebediah has really gotten sick. And I said, okay. I started to go back up there with my King James in one hand and the power in the other, and God said, now wait a minute. How long do you want this little guy? What did you ask for? I asked for a son. Here he is. Here's his name. There's his date of birth. I asked for another chance. You ain't doing no more Valiums now. You don't even want them. Alcohol, all that stuff has never really been an addiction or a problem to me. So how long do you want him to go like this? What do you want him to look like when he grows up? Who are we doing this for? Are we doing this for Zebediah, or are we doing this for Dad, for Dwayne? Right then I said, okay, Lord, I know what you're saying. I ain't going to go ever see Zeb again. Never did I ever go. The same night, my girlfriend's name was Ann. They called again. They said, now, Dwayne, he's getting sick. I said, Ann, go up there and see him. As she held him, Zebediah died right in her arms, right there. It was over. He just quit taking breaths, and he died. Her mother always hated me because I wouldn't go up there that day, you see. But I couldn't. Her mom still to this day, until maybe hope she hears this, always hated me because I wouldn't go up there and watch him die, but I couldn't watch him die because he wasn't going to die if I'd have been there. My faith is so strong, I wasn't going to let my son die. If I was standing there, he ain't dying. But I had to give him up to let him die. Now, that's a cruel thing for a father to say, but that's exactly how it went. So I didn't go so that he could, if he was going to die, could die in his mother's arms, and everything was fine.
That same kind of faith is really what's made you successful today. Tell me, you went through all this, and then you had to figure out how to pick the pieces up and really how to support yourself, and you actually went to work in sales, I guess.
Right. This guy, after Zebediah died, then I preached his funeral. And all the news aired it on TV, and I had a whole sermon ready to go, in the Bible, it speaks about the children shall lead the beast around. And I was getting ready to say all that. And I said the Mother's Day prayer in the penitentiary on Mother's Day. And I had the same thing. I had a speech ready and I threw the speech away and said, ain't nobody gonna call our mamas names. And one thing about it, our mamas are who we love. And all the guys in prison, of course, their mothers got to come in and sat right there with them. And as I threw that paper down, I felt it was like the same prayer.
Wow.
And I just like opened my mouth and all of a sudden came out was, we're not sure that there's no Chapmans in heaven. And all the Chapmans were sitting there.
This is at the funeral.
Right. And Chapmans are my family and the Cowles. And I said, we're not sure that there's a Cowell for sure in heaven. But today we're sure. Because as I'm standing here, there's a Chapman in heaven today. And I could see this little guy as I was burying my son. I could see him like sitting there mixing up concrete in a wheelbarrow, putting bricks up on this house that said dad, you know. I could picture this in my mind that he was there getting my house ready. And that's what I said, you know, to the audience.
Yeah.
And I remember, I've very rarely seen my father cry. And I see my dad cry when I said that. So I knew that, just like I knew the prayer in prison on Mother's Day was the right thing to say, I knew that was the exact right sermon to preach for my son. Mm-hmm. So out of that, someone recognized me on TV and said, now when I was out on bond, for the year I was out on bond for the murder case, I started selling vacuums. And I was pretty good doing it. So this guy happened to recognize I was put on a poster with Kirby vacuum cleaners. Can I say that? The Kirby?
Sure.
I was put on a poster with Kirby and my face, and this guy in Denver happened to see it and said, isn't that guy that's from Texas that sold Kirby's? This guy knocks on my door 3 or 4 weeks later. And he's a Spanish guy, and he says, come on, we're going to go sell some Kirby's. I said, not me. Ah, come on, bud. And I said, no, man, I just got out of prison. I didn't know you're in prison. Put on a cotton shirt. He said, how do millionaires put their pants on? Zip, just like this. And I'd heard all this stuff before, you know. And I thought, how does this guy know exactly what things to say to pull my chain? And it really wasn't just for my chain. He was just saying the right positive things to pull anybody's. And pretty soon, you know, he tricked me, and I love him for this today. And he trapped me into going to show in the Kirby. So anyway, I started from there, and I said, how many Kirbys do you have to sell to be number one in the nation as a personal salesman? Well, our record is 30 months. I sold 31. I said, now how many Kirbys do you have to sell to be an area distributor, open up your own office where somebody comes in and says, I've got money in my pocket, I want to buy something from you, and I don't have to go out there and knock their door to do it. How much? And they said, well, you got to sell this many hundred. I did that. Then they start saying, uh-oh, who is this guy? Then I said, now how many do you have to sell to be able to get the Kirby for very cheap and become a factory distributor, have an office, hire men, promote men, and go up into upper management? You have to sell this many. This is the new rule. So, you know, they've been telling me, this is how many you got to sell for this. So they upped it about 200, which took 3 months longer. But they upped it just a little bit. But they did put it in writing. They did sanction it, and they did send it out. So I had a goal in writing that I could see to sell so many. Within less than a year, bam, I hit it. I wrote the factory and said, now, I'd like this price on the Kirby. They said, uh-oh, who is this guy? And they said, now, a factory distributor can go out now and sell personally and win this diamond ring. I said, what's it called? They said, it's called the president's ring. Well, to me, you know, the president, who's gonna give it to you? The president, they said, and where am I gonna get this at? Chicago, Illinois, at the first major international meeting that Japan, everyone could come to in Chicago, Illinois. Well, my mother got to go as my guest because she was my bookkeeper, and I wanna make mom so proud, get up there and get this president's ring. And when I got up, I could picture myself and them clapping and the president announcing my name and doon 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 doon, Rocky III, here I come down the aisle, Kirby man, you know, really positive. And so I'm standing in line with my little rented tuxedo on that I would never wear, but I had it on for this ring. And I'm standing there and this guy comes up and hands me this box, you know, that with the ring in it, and opens it up and say, here. And I'm standing there with a bunch of award winners in line, you know, and I'm crowding my way the first because I'm going up first. I got the most important award. And he said, there you go. I said, hey, come here, Brian was his name. I said, Brian, wait a minute. I'm going to get this ring in front of him. So, no, you can't, dog. And, you know, now.
In other words, he instead of bringing you up front and giving you the award, they gave it
right,
to you backstage.
Right, you know, backstage where you stand in line waiting to go talk, you know, yeah. They hand it to me there. And I said, well, I'm going to get up there in front of everybody and get this. He said, no, you're not. He said, you're not even going to go out there. So you take the ring and I'll talk, we'll talk to you in a little bit, dog. And, you know, my mom was like in the audience, and then I came back out from behind the curtain, you know, and sat down my mom and gave her the ring. I said, and, you know, my mom just shook her head because I think mom knew all the time. And it was over, you know, the thing, and I went, and the president, Kirby, said, well, we know who you are. I said, what do you mean you know who I am? He said, well, you know, you're in jail for murder. How can we promote anyone like that who goes door to door, deals with women, because it was a woman's product. You couldn't, you know, you couldn't knock a door and sell a man a Kirby, unless his wife approved it, and put you into upper management, because that's what I wanted to go into, enthusing people and making them believe in something they could believe in. And they said, we can't do that with this kind of record and that kind of conviction. I'm sorry, we'd like you to resign. What we're going to do is we're going to let you take the Kirbys that you have in our warehouse right now and sell them to whoever you want to. We're going to let you price them at the price you want to. You know, because the Kirby sold for a lot more money than I thought it actually was worth. And I don't mean to downgrade the Kirby, but I paid a lot less. So they said, we'll let you do all this, but in bottom line, you're out of it.
So you had to sell your stock, basically.
So I had to sell everything I had.
What did that do to you? I mean, it was your whole life. Your whole focus was to do this. I mean, your identity was tied to this. Now they're treating you like a convict again.
Right. I was completely devastated. I thought that, you know, going all through all this that I just went through was for naught. That, you know, I knew that once I told my loved ones, you know, once they find out who I am, it's going to happen. No, it's not. Just keep going. People forgive. You know, things change. And I thought, no way, that wasn't. So then, in the meantime, I had my two sons who were about 10 years old and 9 years old at this time. My ex-wife, while I was in prison, had filed child support on me. While I'd been out of prison, I had tried for 2 or 3 years to locate her or anybody to locate them. I couldn't find them at all. One day, accidentally, I found out where she was. I had her subpoenaed. She went right back to Texas in the same court, the same area that sentenced me, and they told her he must see his children in order to enhance his rehabilitation. Unless you want to be in jail, you let him see those kids. She started letting me see the kids. I went into the judge. The judge said, now you see them, now you pay for them. I said, but look, I've got this used vacuum store. He said, I don't care. You either pay for them, you're going to jail. I explained to the judge, Your Honor, now wait a minute. You're in Colorado, Denver, Colorado. I'm from Texas with a capital T. Nothing that your little prison system here can do. You have no fields. You have no change. You don't have nothing. And yes, I will go to your prison system and I will sit there forever. And I was very serious because Colorado prison system compared to Texas, there's no comparison. I don't know about now, I'm talking about back then.
Yeah.
The judge says, well, here's what we can do. Well, the judge knew me from an early age, said, well, here's what you can do. I've got this guy, here's his name. I want you to go out there. I want you to hunt this guy down. He said, what do you feel like? What would it make you feel like in your heart? Would you be a snitch? Would you be a rat? If you went out and picked this guy up, he's wanted for rape. I said, no. You see, because when I was in prison and a rapist and someone come in, would we be a rat for whipping him? No. So that matched.
So it fit your values.
Fit my value. No, I wouldn't care about going after this rapist. I'd be glad to, Judge. Judge said, good. Here's his name. Go get him. About a week went by.
And he offered you a bounty for it.
He offered me $200 for child support if I caught him.
So the $200 would go take care of your child support.
Yes.
He could go do it.
Yes. So I caught him, brought him in.
How long did it take you?
I think about a week. I don't think any longer. Because yeah. I know I got right on it. It fit. That fit right into everything else I'd been doing previously for the last few years. So I brought him in. I didn't have any handcuffs or nothing. I just tied him with a belt, used the prison style, you rapist, no good scum, put him in the back of the car and drove him into the court.
Right.
Went through the hallways with the belt on the guy. The judge was in court, motioned the judge that I had the guy. The judge motioned the sheriff to arrest him, took him off. Judge said, good. And he said, son, have you ever heard of a bounty hunter? And I had seen Josh Randall, the old bounty hunter, years ago on TV. That's all I seen. So I said, no. He said, well, you go to these bondsmen, you tell them exactly who you are, that I sent you. And without using his name, a lot of the bondsmen would have never given me a job.
Sure.
So I went in and told my name. You know, Colorado hadn't heard of me like Texas had. They said, fine, here's how much. We'll give you $1,000. This is a girl. The second one was a girl. We'll give you $1,000 to bring this girl. She was a biker's girlfriend back to me, and then I'll throw her in jail. So I went home and said $1,000 bills just to go get this girl and bring her in. And, you know, to me, it was like cutting a yard. The grass is long. Here's the mower. Cut it. It's over. $1,000. I mean, that's how simple it was, especially it's a girl. See, a girl ain't going to hurt you. You know, grab her and take her in. It's over. So I went out and found this girl, talked her in with her old man sitting right there. I said, hey, it's over. Would you rather have me take him in than a cop is going to, you know, da-da-da. I said, yeah, brother, okay, follow me to the jail. But she got a ride with me. She got in my car, no cuffs, nothing. He followed me to the bondsman's office. We went in. The bondsman paid me, blah, blah, blah. So then this bondsman started giving me more and more. Then the bondsmen all started hearing about who's this dog guy called the new bounty hunter. Then they started knowing me better because I started working for them. Then they would say, dog, come visit this guy for me. Go visit this guy and see if he's going to run. Dog, would you come into my office? I'll give you $100 just to show up for 15 minutes because I want you to see these people just in case they run. And I would walk in and the druggies or whatever would come in and I'd sit there and say hi and look at them, look at their body language, watch how they act, see what kind of car they drive, get the license plate down on a scratch pad. The bondsman would say, did you get everything? I'd say yes. Then the bondsman started writing bail because they knew me. I heard him say, dog will find her, get her out. She wouldn't have enough collateral.
So they didn't have enough risk.
They didn't have any. Yeah. Because, you know, they wouldn't have enough money or collateral. Say the bond was so high and they didn't have anything to cover that. The bondsman didn't care. We know dog. If we get just a little, we'll get more, whether it will be their body in jail or dog can go collect the money even. Because I'd go and say, hey, now, you know all this guy money. Do I got to put you in jail? Do I got to be a cop to do this? And the guy'd say, no, here's $300. Thanks, brother. Here's a receipt. You know, so they saw they had a good thing. But what it was actually easy for me because it backed up all my biker training. What I do, I went and found the guy. I went and got the body of instead of the drug. With the biker, I ripped the drug off, took the drug, and left the guy. With this, I did the same thing, only I left the drug and took the man in. So it fit with everything I'd ever done since I was 12 years old. This fit right in. So, and I was proud of doing it because then I could look up and pray and say, God, did you see that? Or, you know, many times I had to stand at the door and say, okay, now God, in about the next 2 seconds, I may be right there in front of your face. Now get ready because I'm ready to come right now. But remember the last thing I'm doing, and that's trying to get this guy off the streets. And that was a lot of my motivation. I kind of, at first, I guess you could say, maybe had a death wish, but I had to do it right. I couldn't die like Evel Knievel. Because what God going to say, come on in, you didn't make it over the mountain. But I thought God would say, you were trying to do something good, Dwayne, come on in. So I think the first few months, the judge gave me something to do, and I believe that's the way I was getting to heaven.
Right.
Then I seen, I'm helping these guys. Then I seen little things I would say would help them in their particular habits, or they'd say, you don't know what it's like, man, I've stolen 2 cars and I'm 19 years old. And I'd say, hey man, kick back, shut up, sit down, I'm gonna tell you a story, son. And that, you know, the older I get, seems like the younger everybody else gets, so I could call him son. Mm-hmm. So I got so many that the channels 2, 4, and 9 came to me and said, we want to do a story about you. The Maverick Lawman, they called it. Who's this bounty hunter called the Maverick Lawman? My friends, a couple other people said, do it, but don't give him your name. Gee, and don't let him get your face. Just do it. So I did it. Then the FBI said, well, the rumors on the streets came out from the police department that he knows all the crooks because he was raised in Denver. And you remember, I didn't do much crooked stuff in Denver. It was all in Texas. And he's splitting the bounties. If the bounty was 500, well, dog will go talk to this old boy and tell him he'll give him 250, and then he'll turn him in and get him out and give him the 250. And I'd tell the cops, well, what about 30 days, a guy sitting in jail waiting to get out to get the 250. Oh, well, so, you know, their imagination, they couldn't believe that somebody could do something better than they could. So they had to use their imagination. So because of their talk, the FBI opened an investigation called Dog Lee, the Bounty Hunter. And they put a guy with me one time, and I arrested him. I had him on a certain highway in Colorado, driving into jail. I mean, this was a nice guy. I couldn't tell till after it was over, but sometimes you can ask any police officer, you know, sometimes you don't want to put the guy in jail. And I could tell there was something about this guy. It wasn't his smell or nothing, it was just his, I could feel there was something, you know, what's wrong with this guy? Then the guy offered me money, and then I thought, oh, that's what it is. He's got more money than most of the usual people have. And he said, here, take this. No, take that. No, I said, now look, buddy, I like you and I don't know why, but you got to go to jail. Now, I can give you some names of some bondsmen, or I can do something for you. I can tell you what not to say. I can tell you when they say, have you been stuck in that cell? You say, I ain't been stuck anywhere, but I can't let you go. So I took the guy to jail. We booked him. About a month later, I had a call from a guy in the FBI who is still my very personal friend. But there has been like people that have been stuck in the house where they've yelled outside, you know, I've taken flashlights and stuck them all the way around their house by using sticks. And I put these flashlights on sticks. I had four or five or six of them. I turned them all on and I had a bullhorn I used to control my kids. And I told them, this is a police, you're surrounded, come out, give yourself up right now. You wanna go down in a blaze of glory, buddy, you got it. And he came to the door. I said, come to the door with your hands behind your head, back outside. And then I yelled in the microphone, go cuff him right now, Dwayne. And so I ran up and cuffed this guy. And
so just you with these six, seven
flashlights. It was just me. Nobody was there. Once I got the guy into custody, into the truck, he was so upset he tried to kick out the window of my truck because, you know, cussing me in Spanish because I was the only guy that was there. And he, you know, I led him to believe that the federales had surrounded his house and we were going to either shoot it out or burn him out. But either way, he was coming out alive.
Now, when I first met you 6 years ago, you were dressed quite different than you are today. You used to have an outfit. You had your silver-tipped cowboy boots, and you had that black outfit, and you wore your badge. And I never forget when you showed me your badge, and I looked at it, and I was all impressed. You had this bounty hunter badge, but you made all that stuff up.
Right. I had to have some kind of identification that said who I was. And so I made up my own ID, I put a badge on it. And this was like you say, 8-9 years ago.
Right
now, they've passed laws now that my badge is the last badge. My ID is the last ID. They tried to pass laws. Of course, there was jealousy in this business, and not by law enforcement, but by other bondsmen or by the crook that I was shutting down their $1 million a year operation. And they said, why can this guy be who he is and have a badge? So the legislature passed all kinds of bail bonds laws, badge laws, gun permit laws, tracking laws, interstate, bringing people back. But they said, what we can't do is we cannot backdate these laws. He is not going to be grandfathered in. Dwayne Lee Chapman, also known as Dog the Bounty Hunter, is the last bounty hunter that we're going to let. My attorney is one of the best in the world, and of course my attorney was going to do something, said, look, and he's been doing this for 8 years now, and you haven't ever told him to stop. He's carried that badge around. He's the reason your daughters can walk to that school right now. He's the guy that arrested that rapist that was getting them all, and now you want to take it away? And the judges, both on the state and the federal level, said, no, we're not going to take it away. When his license expires at his death, that's it. But as of right now, the badge is good, the ID is good, and I can still, as of right today, go anywhere as long as someone has a felony warrant, anywhere, United States, Mexico, Canada, and or on the Sabbath, or an Indian reservation, and bring them to justice.
What was interesting to me, though, is that you created all this. I mean, you couldn't carry a gun because you were a felon, right?
Right, never.
And let's talk about that. Have you been in some situations where people are got guns, shotguns, etc., and they're coming after you, or a group of guys, and you don't have a gun? How do you deal with that? How do you capture those guys and bring them in?
I could go with each one. There's probably 50 to 100 out of the 3,000 that have been armed and said, I'm not going right now, okay? So I can kind of give you a scenario on it, but you have to tell each story, each one.
Yeah, well,
but what
one.
You do is be very positive. show no fear whatsoever.
Okay, that same kind of certainty that you had
exactly,
about your
same
boy
kind
living.
Of faith that, you know, Zebediah and Lazarus is going to stand up. The same kind of faith that this guy's not going to shoot me. And, you know, I'm not saying you don't need a gun to bring these guys in.
But you have.
But I've never used a weapon.
So you brought in 3,000 felons, 3,500 felons, I guess. You've broken every record. You brought in every kind of personality you can imagine. You brought in drug dealers. And you've never used the gun in all that time?
Never. Now, on felons, you say, I have probably not, out of 3,500 or 4,000 arrests, there haven't been every single one felons. But every single one has been wanted, and more than half has been felons. Right. But, oh, absolutely, I have more weapons in my little weapon collection.
Well, you used to be wearing all those. Let's talk about what were those weapons you had. They weren't guns.
I had, I used a beanbag gun. It's a little bag no bigger than a golf ball propelled by a CO2 cartridge. I've used a stun gun. I've used a tear gas gun, which is a blank starter pistol. When you're starting a race, you fire it in the air. I've used my radio and pointed it like a gun or like a rifle from a long distance away. And you know, it's all on how you act and how you approach a person that's wanted. And you can't walk up and say, all right, you scum, I finally caught you and you're an arrest punk and you're going to jail. Because if he's got a gun, it's over. He's going to hold court in the street.
Right.
But if you walk up and say, now listen, brother, we got to talk. And this ain't the place to do it. So while I put these bracelets on, we're going to have a talk. I mean, you know, each...
You put him in a trance. Right. You just put me in a trance when you change your voice. Now, one of the things that I loved about you, and quite honestly, when I first heard about you, I was like, I don't want to talk to some guy who's a bounty hunter, goes out and gets people. But the thing that was great about you and still is to this day is that, you know, I know that a lot of times on that ride back in, you're really trying to help these people think about their lives because you really believe in the justice system and you really believe that maybe you might be able to touch them, and you shared your story with them.
Right.
And what do you do, though, with a guy that won't listen to your story? I know one guy, for example, threatened he was going to kill you and kill your children.
Well, this was years ago, and he did that. And I had at that time had a blank tear gas gun in my truck. And he told me, I'm going to bury your family and you. And I pulled the truck over, put it in park, got him out, put the tear gas gun in his head and said, if you believe in Jesus, I'm going to give you a minute and a half to talk to him. Because you're going to hear a loud noise. You're going to hear something vibrate your head, and all you're going to be thinking about is your mother for a few minutes. You're going to feel something warm on the other side of your head. You're going to lose all balance, and then you're going to die. And he said, please, dog, don't shoot me. And I said, well, then don't threaten that you're going to kill me, because if you do, I got to leave you right here. And I talked to this guy 2 days ago. He had just gotten out of prison and, you know, apologized to me, told me my reputation in the penitentiary wasn't really that bad, but advised me never to go. But he said,
yeah, well, but after, you know, putting 3,000 guys away, I guess so.
Right, but you know, I've always have to think, it's just like, I don't know if an athlete thinks this or not, or someone, it's kind of like a convict. You never know really when you might go back, even for something you didn't do. Hmm. I mean, that's always there on my back as long as I live. It's what I do with it.
But you also got to become, you decided to become a bondsman. Why did you do that? And where are you going now? I'd be curious.
Okay.
What have you learned?
I wanted to be a bondsman because, you know, I had seen these guys. I put them in my car or in my vehicle to take them to jail, and none of them were ever counseled. None of them were ever, there was never a step to rehabilitation. So now as a bondsman, I can make it mandatory. I can come get out a friend of ours, say, and you'll say, Dwayne, this guy's got a problem with drinking. And I can say, well, Tony, if we want to keep him free, we're going to make it mandatory that he stay on the Antabuse program. And Antabuse is a drug that will not allow alcohol to enter his body. And if it does, it'll make him sick. So if you say, now, if you want out of jail, I go to visit them, they say, please get me out, dog, please, it's D, I want out. Will you go to Antabuse? Oh, God, yes. Now, everybody says that.
So you use leverage.
Oh, okay, I'll let you go. Then 2 days go by, Chuck calls me up. Okay, thank you, dog, for getting me out. You on Antabuse yet? No, uh-uh. Why not? Well, you know, it's okay. Okay, you come see me, man. I need you to do some paperwork. He comes see me. Chuck, sit down. Put these handcuffs on for me, will you? Why? Because you're under arrest, Chucky. For what? You ain't on Antabuse, boy. But, and you got 24 hours. Little Earl, take the cuffs off him. You'd be back in here with a slip in your hand, and you ain't going to jail. Chuck will go out, and I don't care, you know, whatever it's called, it's legal.
Yes.
And you better make them now, because their parents didn't make them when they were children. So you better make them do it, because it's suggestion. Sometimes will work, but every time, if you make them do it, it'll work.
And once it becomes a habit, you can change the behavior.
That's exactly right. Exactly. So if they want freedom, they get supervision.
Now, I know that, you know, one of the things you've become pretty famous in Denver, and there are some people there in the bondsmen specifically, who are a little resentful of you because all of a sudden they lost you as the way of insuring their bonds. All of a sudden, you know, if they made a bond and somebody ran away, they were left holding the bag and they didn't have dog to go get their guy. So how's that working out for you now?
Well, there was laws they tried to get passed through the legislature that said if you'd ever been convicted of a felony, you'd lose your license. And even after 10, 12 years, you know, my license was up. These judges all heard what I had done, knew me personally. I'd brought prisoners in front of them for the last 6, 7 years. They passed the law, but said not for Dwayne.
So they grandfathered.
They grandfathered me in on that particular one. But the bail bonding is nothing is over in the United States of America.
Why do you say that?
I think that bondsmen are too close to the criminal element or to the criminal mind to be able to be honest. You can stand in the gap between for so long, and sooner or later you got to lean one way.
Yeah, and you've told me about some pretty incredible horror stories.
Oh, yes.
Well, you might share that with some of the bondsmen, what's happened with them. You go out and get one of their people, and what would happen?
Well, I'd bring the guy in, and the guy'd have money on him, and the bondsman would rob him. I'd bring him in, and the guy failed to appear on him. I found the guy, so the bondsman's out nothing but my bounty fees. He's got that, you know, he took that for his collateral. So he'd rob the guy, or the bondsman would take a guy's car, and they call him up and say they take a nice Corvette for collateral, and call you and say, your court date has been postponed until the 1st of December. The officer is on vacation. He's not there. This poor defendant would say, okay, thank you very much, courts. And then I go arrest the guy, and they say, but wait a minute, dog, the court called me. And, you know, this kept happening too many times over and over. And then I go to the bondsman and say, now, it took me 2 days to find this guy. Why are you taking the whole Corvette? You don't have that much money in on this investigation. Never mind, dog. So I said, hey, I want to be what you are, and then you never mind. And it did cause jealousy because they didn't pay for like 6 years any bonds. Right now they're paying almost every single bond that goes bad, they got to pay it. And I mean pay by literally if the bond is $1,000, they within 60, 90 days have to come up with $1,000 cash. I heard the other day a bondsman say on CNN News, our business is 75% less it was a 1 year at this time.
Why?
Because I'm not bounty hunting, I'm not bringing back all them people, I'm not keeping the doors rotating, and I've introduced freedom with supervision. Instead of letting the guy out and saying, Chuck or Joe, you guys have a good day.
In other words, I'll put your bond, I'll see you on your court date. You're saying, I'll put your bond up only if you do X, Y, Z, and keep reporting to me.
Exactly. You must check in. You must go to a drug counselor. You must go to church. You must get a job. I have had kids on bond, 25 years old, that never have had a driver's license. How many times have you been on bond? 16. How many tickets have you had for driving without a license? 12. How come nobody's made you get a license? I don't know. And so in my bonding company, we make them do certain things to satisfy the court, not to satisfy Dwayne Chapman, the bondsman, but the judge is the bottom line. What he thinks happens to your life. That's who I'm trying to influence is that judge. I'm trying to make that guy do things to help his life where that judge can see that this guy has actually done something. You know, there is another way to catch these people and to rehabilitate these people rather than first having them in jail and having something heavy, heavy hang over their heads to do.
So you're trying to take care of it before that happens.
Correct.
Tell me about your girlfriend and how you met her.
My girlfriend's name is Tanya. I love her so much. And I met her in 85 and I arrested her. She had jumped bond. She was one of Colorado's biggest methamphetamine dealers, cooks, yes, and manufacturers. And I met her and, of course, arrested her. And she called me all kinds of names. There was nothing dramatic about the arrest. She just called me a scum bounty hunter, and I put her in jail. And
she was pretty intense, though, wasn't she?
Oh, yeah. But, I mean, it wasn't that.
I mean, I'm talking about guns and the whole bit.
Oh, yeah. It was very hard to get Tawny out of where she was. And once she got out of jail, then she had, while she was in jail, she heard about these other girls coming in that Dog was involved in, and she just was a positive person and was kind of like me, couldn't be, you know, had made a mistake in life and didn't want to be kept down like that. So when she got out of prison, she came to me and said, I want a job. And I said, doing what? She said, being your secretary. And I said, you know, I'm not sure you can do it. She said, if you can do it, I can do it. And all you do is find people, and you don't think I can think like you do. And, I mean, we kind of went like that. She had had some beneficial finance experience, so she could type, use a computer, was very educated, a couple of years of college, could spell words, you know, besides was. And I have since fallen in love with Tawny and is my, not only my woman, but my closest and most dearest friend.
She's a phenomenal lady. I wish you could have been here for this.
Thank you, so do I.
No, she actually was exposed to, I think, one of my tapes, wasn't she, in prison?
In prison, yes.
Yeah. Someone, that's pretty amazing.
Her, one of her parole, or a future parole officer, had seen you, I think, live in Texas, and had written to somewhere to get some of your tapes, and then had turned on some of the girls that he felt. What she did in there is, was she would cook for the guards. Like, I was warden's barber, she was warden's cook. And so, you know, and to be able to be picked like that for guards in either men or women's prison, you've got to have something right about your life. They've got to be able to feel something right. And so, especially to let them cook what you're going to eat.
Yeah.
And they knew that there was something good about Tawny, and one of the guards and the parole guys happened to walk up and hand her one of your tapes. And then when she got out, she heard your name with me and told me more, and you know this to be true, about you than I've ever known. Yeah, as far as your books and all that.
So it's amazing. It's amazing. So I know there's been a lot of threats on your life and on your family, and you want to make some changes now. So what do you see for the future?
I see for the future, I'm doing a lot of, right now, investigations where, kind of like a private eye, I can get in certain communities or certain areas, give a report to what's going on, and leave. I have been very successful in that. I am a father of 7 children, and Tawny, of course, is their mother, and we have custody of all of them, and all of my children are above average in school. They're getting all good grades. Some are even in excelled schools. So Tawny and I together have started helping children, and not just children, but I would say from the age of 9 years old to 40 years old. And then Tawny is always said, well, you want them, you know, that's not fair, Dwayne, that you want them before like we were. So what about the guys that's been there? So we're working somewhat with parole departments right now in states all around the country, to where we take some of the high-risk parolees and try to put them back. You know, a guy will say, well, I had this happen to me when I was 21 years old, and I robbed a liquor store, and that robbery's on my record for the rest of my life, and I can't even get a job as a cab driver. And then I tell Tawny, would you please go get our discharge papers? And we hand this guy Tawny's copy and my copy. I pull out my badge and lay it on the table. I pull out my handcuffs on the other side, and I grab Tawny by the waist, and I said, now when you get done and you think you can be a real Bonnie and Clyde, you let me know, brother. And I have seen so many people say, but dog, I didn't do nothing as bad as you did. And I can say, and look how more you can do for society than I have done. So we have, you know, we're trying to get help the prisoner that's coming out that wants help, and we're trying to help the child or the person who's growing up that maybe doesn't realize that they want help, but that a parent or a loved one sees that they're reaching out for someone to grab a hold of that can fit their personality or can fit into their closed world.
Well, I'm excited about that, and I, as you know, want to help to support you, and I want to tell all the Power Talk listeners that we're going to help you to promote those services, because I know there are so many parents out there that have kids that really need to be turned around and they don't know what to do. And calling Dog the Bounty Hunter might be a very powerful move. And I know Dog can come out and literally work with your young person. That young person may be 20s or 30s, or they might be in their teens, that really have an impact. Because I've watched you with kids, and I'm going to help you to the best of my ability to get you out to the people that need that. And of course, we're going to work together on creating this program for probationers, where we're going to get a chance to work with them as they come out on an ongoing basis, so that we really begin to show them that there is a way to get past their old identity and that they really can make things happen. And the thing that I respect about you, and the thing I'm excited about the program we're going to do together, is we're going to help these people go out and get a job afterwards, right, by talking to people and getting people that are willing to work with someone who really is committed to changing their life. So it's going to be exciting. I really want to thank you. I want to finish with two questions. One thing I want to mention to everybody is, I know one of the things you're going to do is you're going to be writing a book. We're going to help you to pull that off. And now you're very interested in making a movie about your life. And, you know, when Martin Sheen and Emilio and the family came down here to visit, they left fans of yours. So I'm sure that somebody's going to be very excited about that, and we're going to support you in that. But I'm real curious. What, you know, I ask this question to most people I interview, but how do you really want to be remembered? I mean, you've had an unbelievable life. You've had incredible challenges. You've turned them around. You were on the wrong side of the law. You've really tried to give back to society. What's your goal now, and how do you want to be remembered?
How I want to be remembered would be as a good father, or the best father there ever was. I mean, at my time in my life right now, and at my age, and to see my children play, and to see my children learn how to add, learn how to read. And I used to think that some of the greatest moments were when I caught that bad guy, or when I did this, or when I walked in with this guy in handcuffs that nobody else could find. And really, my greatest moment the other day was when Tucker came to me, one of my sons, and read something out loud and knew how to put, it was the directions on a little video game that he could hold in his hand, and knew what the word said, and was so proud when he read it. So I really would like to be remembered as one of the world's greatest fathers there ever was.
I can tell you that you're a phenomenal father, and you're a phenomenal man.
Thank you, and so are you, Tony Robbins, sir.
Well, thank you, sir.
And I would like to say something, okay, and I hope you put this in the tape. I have known Mr. Robbins for 6 or 7 years, and a lot of your recipes to success in life I have been using from before prison till this day, and I will use forever. I did not know how to label each one of those those recipes as you do to succeed. But from the day I met you and read your books until today, I have used those recipes for success in life on a life basis where a lot of people, not just to make a car payment, but whether my heart was going to beat another stroke. And I have never, in meeting FBI agents, meeting anyone, and not just to butter your bread, Tony, have ever met a family or a certain man, you, that has ever been more loving with genuine love, whether it has to do with money or not, or real sharing and caring, than I've ever met. Anybody as young as you are at your age, and as devoted to the human being as you are. And I believe that in the future, more people will use the techniques that you use to stay successful, to keep their marriages together, to keep their children together. And America should use more of those success plans that you have to keep America together.
Well, I certainly wasn't expecting that.
And I mean that, Tony Robbins.
I appreciate that very much, Dwayne. And I could mirror back all the things that you said, because I brought you on this tape for one reason. I respect you as much as anybody I know.
Thank
because
you.
You're a man of absolute conviction. And whatever you give your word to, you will do. And I know of so many people in life who have turned around great challenges, but you've turned around all those challenges by constantly staying in touch with your heart, and by living with absolute integrity, and by constantly doing what you thought was the right thing. And I think your example is one that we all could model and need to model in terms of commitment and integrity. And so I hope that people will hear this. I hope they'll contact you. I hope that people that are interested in your services will reach you. But I also hope that people are reached by your heart and your sincerity. I wish they could see your face on the video, and they could see how you move and your gesture. Maybe that'll happen sometime in the future. But I hope all of you listening have been touched by this unique man. I know I have. And I again thank you.
Thank you.